Today on Theatre Voice, we are interviewing Roxana Silbert, who is probably best known for her work at Payne's Plough, where she's the artistic director. She's agreed to come in to talk to us particularly about what's now known as Shoot, Get, Treasure, Repeat, which is the Mark Ravenhill sequence that has been taking place across London recently. It's 16 short plays that started off as Breakfast with Ravenhill in Edinburgh and got a jazzier title that she might wish to explain to us a little bit more. Also, she's going to talk to us about Payne's Plough and what it means to be running a peripatetic company that is probably as good at new writing as possibly even the Bush or the Royal Court or the Trevis, where she worked in the... I've probably worked at most of those at various times, actually, or all of those, in fact. So, Roxana, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello, very nice to be here.
First of all, I think the Breakfast with Ravenhill was a strange event because I went up to Edinburgh and thought, gosh, all these things at the Trevis at 9:30 in the morning, it sounds a bit like Richard and Judy, I'll duck them. And I only kind of caught up with it late in the day and I was lucky. I think I was blown away with the one I saw. I've seen or read all 16 now, and I think probably maybe 10 of them are very good, another two or three are good, and some of the others are filling the gaps. Where did it come from? How did this concept come about?
Mark approached us, and he wanted to write a play a day during the Edinburgh Festival, which is basically 17 days. And he... at that stage, what he wanted to do was explore the epic form, and he wasn't imagining that these plays would all be complete. He was imagining that they were really a sort of exploration or investigation of epic form. And so he started to write, and as he wrote, things emerged. So ideas that were through connected, characters that were through connected, stories that were through connected, and he began to think about it in a different way. So it emerged very organically, and then he realized that actually he thinking about writing an epic play around the themes and ideas and people that he wanted to explore, the fragmentation actually served him and was closer to the way that he understood and viewed the world than trying to write a three-hour play with a three-act structure or a more traditional structure. And he talks about that very fluently in some of the journalist pieces that he's written, and about how after having had an epileptic fit, which he had just before he wrote the plays, that his sense of life is something quite fractured and memory of something quite fractured somehow sat with him more truthfully than the idea of something that sustains and builds in what one might consider a more traditionally dramatic way.
And did he really write a play a day?
He did write a play a day. I mean, he wrote a play a day. We went up with five plays, so we knew that we knew what the first five plays were. And then he wrote a play a day for the 5 days before we went up, and then he sort of started to write the rest as we got there.
And it's remarkable. I was perhaps a little bit demeaning about a couple of them, but the quality throughout the epic sequence is amazing, I think.
Well, I think that's what was extraordinary. I mean, obviously we took a complete risk because we had no idea what he was going to write. And I think what's extraordinary is actually that he wrote such consistently high quality work, because I think anyone, however brilliant, you would expect some to be better than others. But they are all of a quality, which is undeniable. I think that's an incredible achievement.
Did you do the commissioning in Edinburgh? So did you pick the directors and the actors?
Yes, we did. Payne's Plough produced the whole 17 readings in Edinburgh. And the idea was to use the talent that was already at the festival. So we were casting from people who were either based in Scotland or who happened to be visiting the festival. And we wanted to have as many directors and actors involved as we could. So we had, again, visiting directors. And the great thing about that was that we were able to go quite international. So there was a fantastic New York company there. And the director directed with he happened to have three actors. So we gave him a play with three characters so that he could bring his company. We had a director from Dubai. We had a German director. So it was really interesting watching all the different takes, because obviously coming from different theatre cultures, people brought different approaches, and I think it was also a great experience for the actors working with people they probably would have never worked with before.
Certainly, I spoke to a couple of actors who were also very pleased to get the chance to play at the Travers, which they hadn't before.
Yeah, I mean, it was 17 players, and there is between 2 and 10 people in each play. It's an awful lot of characters and actors, and it was partly about giving opportunities. We tried to give opportunities to young directors and young actors, and especially for young Scottish directors, who there's not a lot of openings in Scotland for directors, and so it was great to be able to give, well, at least 5 young directors in Scotland an opportunity to direct at the Travers.
And then it kind of disappeared for a bit. I believe there was something at Hampstead that I didn't even hear about, and then it reappeared for very, very short runs in London. I mean, the one at the Gate, I think, had a total audience of about 30 people. How did that come about, and how did it end up being at 4 venues, was it 5 venues, across a 2 or 3 week period?
Well, I think you have to understand that when we went to Edinburgh, there were no plans to do anything with that show. The idea was that Mark was going to take that material away and then fashion it in some form. And so it took a while for him to think around how he might want to try it. And so what we did at Hampstead, which was part of their... They had a sort of Daring Pairings Festival, which was a week of new plays or new events. And one of the things we wanted to see is how they would work as an evening. So we put 5 together and did basically 2... I mean, they're 20 minutes each, so it was about 2 hours. And we felt that doing a block of 2 hours was not the best way to present the material. They're too full in their own right, and you come away a bit overwhelmed and emotionally numbed by the event. So we then were considering... We felt that it was really important that there was a sense of event around them. And we started talking to Dominic Cook at the Royal Court, and Dominic started talking about the Anthony Gormley statues and how, you know, what a joy it is to sort of walk through the city and, oh, there's an Anthony Gormley statue that's popped up, or sculpture, I should say. And we thought about that as an inspiration for a form, really. And the idea that you know that they would pop up all over the place. I think that also there's a lot of interest at the moment in looking at different ways of presenting theatre, different times, different places, and that's certainly something Payne's Power is really interested in. So we were, and I know that the National, I've been quite interested in exploring those different times, and the Royal Court wanted to see if people would come and see shows late night, early evening. So it seemed like a possibility to bring 5 or 6 companies together to present the whole cycle, because they work as individual plays, but if you start to see them together, then they do something slightly different, and there's something just quite exciting about the randomness of what you might see and how that might connect to something else that you might see or not.
For those who didn't actually see the plays, you want to give us a very, very brief idea of the themes that Mark was exploring?
Yes, I mean, I think almost all the plays are somehow a response to a warlike situation, and a war more in the sense of terrorism than an out-and-out war. That's what the plays are looking at. They're also looking a lot at personal people who are absolutely average, normal kind of people trying to live their best lives, dealing with a situation that's beyond their ken, and media, which is where the title comes from, and media responses to and media, our relationship to the media and the media's relationship to reporting terror and war situations.
You mentioned Payne's Plough earlier, and clearly I'm going to let you get back to the company. You've had involvement for a long time now. Do you want to tell us about the ethos of Payne's Plough? I just find it really interesting.
Well, Payne's Plough has been going for about 32 years. It's always produced new plays. It started up actually to present the work of one writer, David Pannell, and then sort of diversified. And the ethos changes from artistic director to artistic director. I mean, at the moment we are interested in contemporary plays, which is plays that somehow have a relationship with the contemporary world. We're working with a mix, and we want to continue working with a mix of experienced writers like Mark and Rona Munro and Sebastian Barry, and launching new writers like Tom Wharton Smith and Duncan McMillan and Katie Douglas. And we really want to keep that balance going, because I think those things feed off each other. The company does three strands of work. The company does what I would call benchmark productions, which are absolutely straightforward production. So we did Levi David Adai's new play, House of Agnes, at the Oval earlier this year. We did Rona Munro's Long Time Dead at the Travis and Plymouth Theatre Royal last year. But we also do the sort of grassroots work that a lot of the companies producing new plays do, which is workshops to try and discover and stimulate and encourage emerging writers and young writers, that's fairly standard. I think that because we aren't venue based, we're able to do another strand of work, which Shoot, Get, Treasure, Repeat emerged out from, which is what we call platform performances, which is to respond quite spontaneously and quite fast, because we don't have a very large institution to deal with, to writer-led ideas, and to produce work that is, it's a brilliant play with brilliant actors in it, but it's also part of an event. So Play Pie and a Pint or Raven Hill for Breakfast or Shoot, Get, Treasure, Repeat came through those ideas of just thinking about how you can put theatre in the centre of someone's cultural life without it being a sort of exclusive experience. I think what's really interesting for companies like ours, and we're a company that started off in the 70s as part of a lot of touring companies, so people like ATC and Cheek by Jowl and Max's old company Joint Stock, is that those companies were set up to tour so that they could take good quality theatre out of theatres and to people's lives. And there was a very well-established touring circuit through the 70s and 80s that made that possible. That touring circuit's broken down. That doesn't exist. So we have to rethink how we make theatre accessible and get those plays out to people in new ways. And that's a lot of what's driving us at the moment.
Do you look for different audiences? Play a Pie and a Pint, I think I raved about. It was just the most incredible experience. And it was interesting that, yes, there were familiar faces in there, but are you particularly striving to get new audiences, people who don't go to theatre?
Yes, I mean, we're very lucky because our audience is very young and very diverse. And we want to try and get audiences in who perhaps would not go to buy a ticket at a box office in a main theatre. I mean, that is what we can offer as a peripatetic company that other theatre companies can't, really. You know, we can do that because we can go other places. So I feel we're sort of on a bound to try.
Does that then make you deliberately take on different types of theatre, take on plays that others would regard as very risky? And the previous season, I remember, was the sensational one called, was it called This England or something like that? This Other England, forgive me, which was at the Menier. And I know Philip Ridley with Mercury Fur managed to make the headlines in the press. But it also contained quieter, thoughtful plays like whichever the David Gregg was that time around. Thank you. I hope to see this kind of thing. You've been associated with Mark Ravenhill with Sarah Kane, so that's at the forefront of in your face. Yeah. Is it deliberate policy of Payne's Plough to try and go for things a little bit more daring or shocking?
I don't think one thinks about it as daring or shocking. I mean, I think one's looking for very individual voices. And we're very playwright biased. So we're really looking to discover and treasure someone who has a very individual voice. And that might take many forms. I mean, Enda Walsh, I think, is an extraordinary playwright who has a glorious voice. He's not a sensationalist writer in the way that maybe Philip or Dennis Kelly can be. Yeah. And I don't think those playwrights try to be sensationalist. I think that is their sensibility and their take on the world. And I'm excited by people who have a strong sensibility and a strong take on the world. And those are things that you can't give people or teach people. That is who they are and what they bring to their writing. So it's not so much looking for something that's daring. It's looking for something that's individual and true, I'd say.
You must have been an absolute natural. Vicky Featherston was running it before you went on to the National Theatre of Scotland, but you must have been natural to take over because the kind of work you've done in the past just seems like Payne's plough work. I'll just pick one at random, Rona Munro's Iron, which did incredibly well in Edinburgh, came down, was a success in London, awards here, there and everywhere for very good reason. Presumably you're very pleased to have this job.
I'm absolutely delighted to have this job, and I think that Vicky and John left the company in extraordinarily, left it extraordinarily well positioned. I took over just as this other England season was launching, and I think, as a peripatetic company, one of the challenges is to keep your profile high, because you're working all over the place. So, we're doing a lot of work outside of London that doesn't get reviewed or reported. And I think it's very important work, but it's also true that people don't have a sense of your identity because they can't connect you to one writer or one venue or one actor. And so the only thing that people can connect you to is a spirit and a sense of an adventure. And I think that that Vicky and John had that in Bucket Loads, and I felt that was a similar spirit to my own. And rather bizarrely, I replaced John at the Traverse. So in fact, I just follow John Tiffany around. John was the literary associate at the Traverse, which I took that job when he left to come to Payne's Plough, and then when he left to go back to Scotland, I came to run Payne's Plough. So there is, a natural kind of shared taste, I'd say.
Does this mean that you're going to be heading for the National Theatre of Scotland next?
I don't think so, no. I think they're pretty well set up there. Yeah. I mean, they're doing an enormous amount of work.
Do you actually feel is it 3 years in this job, roughly? Do you actually feel that at some point in the not-too-distant future it would be nice to work in a fixed theatre?
We do work in a lot of fixed theatres. Working in a building, I've been an associate in three buildings now. You do know your audience a great deal better, and you do get to know and love the space you're working for. And there is a great sense of having a lot of expertise around you, which, Payne's Plough is four people. So there's not a marketing department, and there's not a production department, and there isn't that sort of support network and just that brilliant expertise that you get. But it does mean that we can work in lots of buildings, and also it means that the plays can be placed in the best place for them, which is what I really love.
So is that the end of life for what's now known as Shoot, Get, Treasure, Repeat, or does it still have something of a future, and what's going to happen with Payne's Plough from then onwards?
Shoot, Get, Treasure, Repeat is going to some selection of plays are going to the Latitude Festival in Suffolk, which is a music festival, and to the Northwall Festival in Oxford during July. And there's been a lot of international interest in it, and I'm sure it will pop up in various countries. I know it's going to Moscow very soon, Germany, Crete, and again, people are wanting to do the entire cycle, so I think it will have a future life. Payne's Plough, our next production, is a new play by Sebastian Barry, and it's quite an interesting project because it's a co-production with Canterbury Cathedral, and the play's being performed in Canterbury Cathedral in September and then hopefully touring. And Canterbury Cathedral had a tradition of commissioning plays, so Murder in the Cathedral is probably the most famous one that was commissioned, and then basically for 50 years didn't do any theatre. So the Canterbury Festival has focused on producing music, But the new dean is very keen to commission new plays again, and we are hopefully the first of a series of plays that will be commissioned by them. So that'll be a fascinating experience, I think.
I've got to say, a combination of a cathedral and Payne's Plough does seem about as odd as it gets.
Yes, it is quite odd, but as you can imagine, there's no reason why Canterbury Cathedral will have a specialist in producing and commissioning new plays. So they were looking for a partner who could work alongside the playwright, really. And we just thought it's such an incredible space, and it also allows a writer to write something epic, really genuinely epic, in a way that most theatre spaces don't. And they wanted a play which was dealing with or looking at the spiritual life, contemporary spiritual life, not religious, but spiritual and philosophical. And I just think that's an area of theatre that we lose, because we get very gritty and very domestic and very issue-based. And I think the idea of being able to explore a more philosophical and spiritual side of living was just a really exciting prospect.
Fantastic. Roxana Silbert, thank you very much indeed.